Okay, doors closed, so we'll get started. My name's Daniel Smith, for those who don't know me, and that's enough for me. You're here for this session, hopefully. You can see where you are. I'll do a brief introduction of all three speakers, and then we'll get underway. So, Carrie Hellenius beside me, he's a qualified fellow for over 20 years, and has worked in the financial services and equity markets for over 25 years. He was formerly an equity and partner and executive director at Goldman Sachs, JB Weir, and spent 10 years as a senior research analyst covering the insurance and gaming sectors, and 5 years in the investment banking division. Carrie's based here, that's why he's a good guy. And he's currently the Executive Director of Capital Advice and Market Eye, and the Director of Equity Risk Management as well. So lots of directors. Kevin Gomes on my left has over 25 years experience as an actuary in a wide variety of fields. He's specialised in general insurance since the mid-90s and worked in a consultancy environment since 2002. He's currently with Taylor Fry, which a few of us here are, and he's a keen share market investor and enjoys searching for tools which might give him an elusive edge, which I think that is saying he's not into horse racing but doesn't mind betting on the stock market. Graham on the far right, or my far right, your far left, has over 25 years experience as an actuarial analyst in GI, started off in Tillinghast, before joining Taylor Fry and when we were founded, and he's had a lot of experience in terms of valuing long tail classes of business. He's had a lot of experience in building our footy tipping models and all those sorts of things, and the NRL models, and so this, I suppose, is a little bit of an extension into let's make real money rather than sports money.
Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Daniel. So I'll start just by giving an outline of the presentation that we'll be giving today. So we'll be talking about the modelling that we've done in this area, and really the modelling was in a couple of phases. So phase one was of our modelling. It was looking at analysing financial management levers, and we'll explain a little bit more about what that involves as we go through the presentation. But it was analysing those levers for the purpose of assessing company management. And in doing that, there were some constraints on that model which we released really in phase two of our model. So phase two of our model, which will be the main focus of what we're talking about today, is the analysis of those financial management levers, but for stock selection purposes. Phase one model was originally the subject of a presentation at the 2013 Actuaries Summit. Apologies, if you attended that presentation, you might see some slides here that that we actually presented 2 years ago, but not too many of them. So most of the material really we're presenting here is new. We thought it was appropriate, though, that we revisit that that phase one model and represent some of the slides so that the evolution into the phase two modelling could be better understood. But since our 2013 Actuary Summit presentation, we actually received interest from a number of ASX-listed companies who were interested in applying our research to help assess their management performance or fine-tune their corporate strategy, and a few other interesting applications, such as providing an input to how they remunerate their executives. So we thought it was worth just presenting a few of the case studies of how our phase one model has been applied since it was developed a couple of years ago. So that's the middle part of our presentation. We'll be going through a few of those case studies. And then we will focus on our phase two modelling, which really has been able to improve our phase one modelling by easing some of the constraints that apply to it. So let's just begin with a few basics, and I'll start by defining what shareholder return involves. So nothing too surprising here. You'll see the definition down the bottom of the screen, which is It's defined as the share price change as well as dividend yields received over a period of time. In modelling shareholder return, we haven't really made any adjustment for imputation credits. And it's possible that you could make some adjustment for it, but we've kept it fairly simple and just defined shareholder return in that way. And when we look at the drivers of the shareholder return, we've divided into two basic categories here, which we're labelling our Qs and our Ps. So the Qs are the quantitative factors. So this will be things such as return on equity, level of gearing, and payout ratios or company cash flow. These are all things that are objectively measurable, and so there's no subjectivity around them. And we also regard these items as largely under a company's influence, and the importance of that you'll see is we then use that to assess company management, because they are factors that are under the company's influence. The other factors that drive a share price and shareholder return are the Ps, and so price, of course, the actual share price, the perception of the company in the market, and the prospects of that company, so the future prospects. Now, the price is not really within the management control, and the perception and the prospects, whilst they may be to some extent, are not really objectively measurable factors. So they're more subjective. So management, our hypothesis is that management can drive a company's total shareholder return over future periods by appropriately managing their company financials. So really it's the Qs. So we think, you've probably heard the saying, mind your Ps and Qs. Well, we've kind of rearranged it to be, we think companies should mind their Qs and the Ps will take care of themselves. So that was our hypothesis. And we set about to test the hypothesis. So we constructed a model which explored the relationship between a company's reported financials and their relative TSR, relative total shareholder return. So just to explain, what is the relative total shareholder return? So this is quite simply the shareholder return relative to the market average. So, for example, a relative TSR of 2% indicates a company has outperformed the market by 2% during the relevant period. And we modelled relative TSR rather than TSR itself. Our model was built using extensive data. So we had a universe of, we were put on this slide, it's 225 companies, but it was really more than that. It was, the number of companies varies as you look over time within the market. At any point in time in our model, we had at least 225 companies, but quite often it was a lot more than that. We had six monthly data points, so whenever a company reported their financials, that provided us a data point, and we captured all of the relevant data on that company at that six monthly point, and we looked at it over 12 year periods. So if you just do the simple maths there and multiply that out, that gave us about 81,000 data points. Just to re-emphasise, we only included ratios which were clear and objective measures, so there was no input on our part to change any of that, that the data was the data, really. And we found a very strong relationship for certain ratios. So you can see the ratios that we tested listed there. Some of them came through much stronger than others, and not all of them made our final model, but they were the measures we tested. So ROE, change in ROE, ROFE, NPAT growth, and so on. So you can see them all listed over there. So we found relationships on a one-way basis between the relative shareholder return and many of those ratios that you saw. But really, I mean, we then applied multivariate modelling techniques to combine the effects of those ratios. So the contribution of each financial ratio to explaining the relative TSR was measured using these multivariate modelling techniques. And the resulting multivariate model was used to rank and group companies in our universe of stocks into quartiles according to their predicted relative TSR level. So companies in the top quartile were really those which represented those with an optimal mix of financial parameters across P&L, cash flow and balance sheet. So when we were originally working with that base one model, and keeping in mind the purpose was to assess company management and corporate strategy, we really decided that we couldn't include those ratios which were not within company management control. And the two that stick out here are the two that we've circled down the bottom, so the dividend yield and the PE. Both of those, of course, involve the company share price as within there, and as I've said before, that's something we did not see as within the management control, so we excluded those, even though they are very, very strong effects on the shareholder return, but we excluded them for our phase one model. However, we added them back in for our phase two model because they do provide our phase two model on stock selection, because they do provide useful information on valuation levels. And there's no real rationale for excluding them when you're not trying to form an assessment of company management, when you're focused on just trying to select a stock, then it'd be silly to ignore valuable information from the dividend yield and PE. Okay, so I'll now hand over to Carrie, who will talk through some of the case studies of our phase one modelling.
Yeah, so just on that phase one, how could we use that information and actually take it to corporates? Because it became sort of quite an interesting exercise. Most of the ASX-listed companies at the moment would make their financial decisions based on judgment, based on gut feel, sometimes based on investor recommendations. An investor might ring them up and say, you know, it's a good idea to do this or to do that. And they debate these at board level and then make a decision about, you know, their financial prospects or their strategy going forward. And no one really at the moment is providing any real evidence to the company, to the management, to the board to necessarily help support that decision or challenge that decision that they're making around these sort of financial aspects. So one of the key things that we could do with corporates is to analyse using the model and using the heat maps that we've developed to see where the company's how the investors were responding to the company's financial management, what were investors seeing as the key financial ratios for that company, and they vary from company to company, and also compare that to what the company itself saw as its key financial drivers and how it was managing the business. So in this first case study, it was one around corporate strategy, and we analysed all the factors that we'd shown on that previous chart. And in the process of doing the modelling, we produced these heat maps, and the colour coding there shows that a red area is an area you don't want to be in. That's where the market has typically treated you in a very negative way. The dark green is the most positive area to be in, and then the various shades of green and pink. If you're in the green, you're in positive areas. If you're in the pink or red, you're in negative areas. And so this first one is a chart that just showed dividend yield versus payout ratio. And this company in question had seen itself as being priced on earnings per share growth and dividend yield. And you can see that it has, because these dots here show the history over time of how this company has been in the market. The smallest dot was the furthest away and the largest dot was the most recent. And so you can sort of follow the snail trail around. And when you see a green dot, it means it's outperformed the market. When you see a pink dot or a red dot, it's underperformed. And you can see here that it's always in this pink area. So this is a chart showing dividend yield versus the payout ratio. And you can see it's been lifting the dividend yield's been going up, and you can see that it's been lifting its payout ratio by moving across here over time. So the company was managing itself around trying to drive its payout ratio, but the analysis was showing that they weren't really getting credit for it. I mean, they were always in this area that's typically not really favoured. They weren't getting the right combination of dividend yield and payout ratio to be in an area up here in the green where the market would actually respond positively to that. So that challenged their view on what they saw as important drivers. And when we looked at it for earnings per share growth, we saw a similar sort of thing. There was no real relationship between their earnings per share performance and the market response to that. So, but going through the analysis, we did find that there was another chart which we produced, which was return on funds employed. And so this shows the change in return on funds employed versus the level of return on funds employed. And you can see that there's this sweet spot, the green area, is where you'd like to be. The pink area is sort of getting to negative territory. But now if you look at the colour of these dots, you can see a red one here, a couple of greens in here, then you can start to see some, you know, reds and pinks as it's starting to move out. And you can also see a trend that is coming out into a deteriorating position on its return on funds employed. So what that tells us is that, first of all, the market is looking at this, seems to be looking at this factor, giving it credit when credit's due, more often than not, and giving it a penalty when the penalty is due. And also, they're saying that it's starting to deteriorate on this measure in terms of the market treatment of it. So this factor was more important than that factor. And when we went through that analysis, the CFO of this company, the penny dropped, and it was a really insightful meeting for him because he sort of started to understand where the analyst questions had been coming from, what they'd been looking at. He had the view that the dividend yield wasn't the right way to go because they had been lifting their payout ratio and not really seeing the market response for that. But this gave him some evidence that he could start to rethink and see what investors were actually treating as a more important factor for this company. So they were able to incorporate that in their strategic thinking, in their strategic plan, and put that to the board and start to change the way that the company is positioning itself. Having said that, there's two elements to this. One is you can change your strategy, but you also need to have the operational elements coming through to help support that as well. So it's not clearly just by identifying it doesn't necessarily solve your problem, but at least you are now aware of the problem that previously they hadn't been aware of. There was a whole lot of other... These are just two samples out of that analysis. There was a whole lot of other charts which also helped support the view. And there were other things that came out of it as well. But it was a really interesting way, and when we presented that to the company, first it was to the CFO and you could just see the penny dropping, and then went back and presented it to seven members of the senior team, and then they took a condensed version of that to the board. So it worked very well. Another way that we used the information was in setting executive remuneration, because that's a really hot spot. You know, when you go to your AGM, if your remuneration report gets voted down, there's a three strikes policy, and then they could effectively call for a spill of the board. So no one wants to be in that position of having three strikes, and there's a lot of analysts and proxy advisors who really push in this area of remuneration and challenge the way that remuneration is set for executives in a company. So this enables a company to set its executive remuneration in a way that's aligned with shareholder interests. And essentially here, the company gave us their definition of return on capital employed. They thought that return on capital employed might be something that we could determine a relationship with relative to TSR. So we actually did the analysis for them, and we found that, yep, sure enough, the return on capital employed did have a relationship. Interestingly, the company wasn't getting credit for it. There's a lot of pinks and reds in there, so even though it was in the right area, perhaps that's why they wanted to use this measure. They probably felt they were doing the right thing on this measure, but they weren't necessarily getting the reward for it. But nonetheless, it was something that was under management influence. And so the process that we did was, first of all, we identified there was a relationship, and then we could look at where this company was positioned relative to its peer group. And so from that, you could set parameters. You could set, first of all, the minimum hurdle so that the company achieved a return on capital employed to put it into an area that should be rewarded by shareholders. And secondly, we could look at, you know, the top quartile of the peer group and set a hurdle there so that for the options and things to become fully payable, they had to sort of get into that top quartile. So again, it was it meant that after that, they could have discussions with proxy advisors and with their key investors and frame it in a way to say that they're setting their executive remuneration in a way that is aligned with shareholder interests, that if they achieve those hurdles, they should be moving into areas that get rewarded by investors. then there was a really interesting one around a company approached us to sort of say, well, they were looking at an acquisition strategy, and they wanted us to determine whether there was a relationship between debt and equity funding as to whether it made a difference in terms of total shareholder return in the case of an acquisition. So here we had to do a subset of the database, and we only looked at the data where assets increased by more than 15%, total assets increased by more than 15%, and used that as a proxy for acquisitions. When we started to look at that information, it became really clear that there were certain scenarios where you had a very high positive frequency, where the green bar is above the red bar. That's saying there was the total number of positive outcomes was in excess of the negative outcomes. And the blue down here is showing us it's above the line, so you're getting a positive relative total shareholder return coming out from that scenario. Versus another end bookend was where there was a higher red bar, so a higher number of negative occurrences coming out, and an overall negative average coming out, depending on your mix of debt and equity funding. Now, you might not always be able to position yourself at that end or that end, but somewhere in between, there's a scenario where, you know, it fits within the company's constraints, and they could position themselves with a mix of debt and equity in a theoretical sense that should have given them a positive outcome. In fact, pleasingly, this company actually did recently pursue an acquisition and did take on board the advice, and certainly the initial response from the market has been extremely positive to that. So it did seem to come out in practice, which is nice. The next one was another scenario where a company was looking at capital management initiatives and was trying to weigh up a buyback versus payment of the dividend and also taking into account franking. So again, we were able to break up the database and look at scenarios where the number of shares on issue had declined, so in other words, representing a buyback, and also look at various dividend scenarios and also look at the level of franking as well. But in this case, there were a number of scenarios where, again, the red bars way above the green bars. So following this strategy, or this strategy, there was a very high frequency based over the last 12 years of negative occurrences. We did break it up in time periods as well, recent, more recent, and overall. But nonetheless, very high negative frequencies of occurrence and also negative outcomes coming through in terms of the average. But in this case here, in scenario C, a higher level of positive outcomes and also a positive return, relative total shareholder return coming out of it. So again, the company was able to, and that challenged their thinking actually, because they were thinking certainly not in scenario C, they were thinking, you know, more a scenario A type situation. So it challenged their thinking as to what they should be doing, and again, they were now more able to reprioritise their strategies. In this case, it's probably not something that you'll see the share price jump up on the back of, but at least it could potentially protect that company from having a massive hit to its share price, which if it followed the wrong strategy, it may have done. So with that they're the actual examples, and now we'll hand over to Graeme to talk about phase two.
Thanks, Gary. So Kevin is covered some of this, but I'll give a brief overview of the model and then go through some of the findings. So we applied a generalised linear model. The explanatory variables were company financials measured over a year, taken from the balance sheet, cash flow, and P&L. The response variable was relative total shareholder return measured over the following year. And as Kevin has already mentioned, that's change in share price, including dividends. One point to note about the financials is that although the June financials, end of June, most companies' financials are released in August, and all companies' financials are released by mid-September. This is phase one modelling, so this model excludes dividend yield and trailing PE. It's a heat map of actual relative TSR by ROE and change in ROE. So the relationships are fairly intuitive. Companies with high ROE and a large change in ROE outperform the market, companies with a low ROE and a reduction in ROE tend to underperform the market. If we go to phase two model, so this now includes trailing PE and trailing dividend yield. As Kevin has said, we've selected trailing as they are objective measures rather than, say, prospective PE, which is more subjective. The chart on the left is another heat map of actual relative TSR, and the chart on the right is an exposure map. Again, the relationships between PE and dividend yield and relative TSR are fairly intuitive. Companies with low PE tend to outperform. Companies with low PE and dividend yield strongly outperform the market. This is split into periods June 2010 and prior and post to highlight recent trends. So if we go to the period post June 2010, the same similar charts. Roughly similar relationships, although there are some differences. One being there's been a change in exposure. So dividend yield is now increasing. There's more observations at higher dividend yield. And if we can, it's probably more clearly seen on this chart, which is the one-dimensional chart on the left. The chart on the right is the same. So it can be clearly seen that there's been a shift in dividend yield post-June 2010. Now, if we compare the pre-June 2010 and post-June 2010 heat maps of actual relative TSR, we can see a couple of distinct differences. The first being companies with low PE, low dividend yield, now underperform the market. And companies with mid-range PE and high-range dividend yield tend to outperform. The next few slides are touch on model validation. As we calculate relative TSR, the mean at any point in time is zero, and that's shown by the red line, and the blue line is the average of the predicted relative TSR for all companies at that time point. So this is showing there's not much bias over time, and that even holds when we're projecting future relative TSR. Remembering that financials at June 2014 project relative TSR at June 2015. So the green area is a future projection. If we just flick back to phase one model, so excluding dividend yield and PE, or trailing dividend yield and PE, this is a chart of the average actual relative TSR by predicted quartile. So there's very good differentiation using the predicted top and bottom quartiles. And it's saying that the predicted top quartile, the actual relative TSR of those companies is 9% greater than the average. And the bottom quartile, the actual relative TSR is 6% below the average. Now, the next chart is the same chart, but phase two modelling. And the separation between the bottom and top quartiles has improved. So top quartile, the actual relative TSR for the predicted top quartile is 11%, and the bottom quartile is 7%. So it's gone from a separation of 15% to 18% after introduction of dividend yield and PE. And this is a chart of just plotting the top quartile and bottom quartile for the phase one model and the phase two model. The phase one model being the dashed line, the phase two model being the bold line. So what would the return be if we had invested in the top quartile of predicted companies? The timeline here shows how this backtesting was done. As mentioned before, the company financials are over the year to June 2013 in this example, but the financials aren't released, most of them in August, and all by mid-September. So during the grey box period, the market reacts to the release of company financials. When all company financials are released, we then can model what the predicted top quartile will be. So we get the predicted top quartile of companies. We invest in those companies over 4 months until the next set of financials are released, and then repeat the process. So we've back-tested over the 11, 12 years doing this. The results of that back-testing, so pre-GFC, there was a market outperformance of 3.7% per annum. Post-GFC, we're not putting much weight on. One of the financials is time-dependent. So all the other financials in the model are independent of time. So that's affected by hindsight, so we're not, as I said, we're not putting much weight on that. Post-GFC, there's only a modest outperformance of 0.5%. Recently, though, we've applied prior price momentum filters to try and improve that figure, and we're coming up with 3 to 4% per annum outperformance. Obviously, there's a lot of more work to be done in on filtering and trying to improve the model in this respect. I'll hand back to Kevin now.
So just to summarise then what we've done and what we've found. So we feel our research has some important implications. I mean, we set out really our hypothesis was that we could look at the certain financial ratios and find a relationship between those ratios and the company's shareholder return and their relative shareholder return. And indeed, that is what we found. We found a strong relationship. And we combined those ratios into a multivariate model which can be used to predict a company's TSR relative to the rest of the market. So our phase one model, which was really about assessing company management, yeah, we developed that initially and it was successful at doing that. And our phase two model, which is about stock selection, was subsequently developed and found to offer superior performance. I mean, we were happy really with our performance on the phase one model, but it got better under our phase two model, understandably, because we introduced a couple of new factors that we had deliberately excluded earlier on. And we're very happy with the NAND stability to predict the top and bottom quartile performance. As Graham alluded to, the work's not done. We're seeing it as a little bit of a work in progress, but the level of the back testing would indicate that that it is able, the model we already have can beat the market. What are the applications? You saw some of the applications when Carrie was talking about the case studies. They were primarily on our phase one model, and we've already been using it to help companies with a range of different applications, assessing their management performance, setting executive remuneration rewards, evaluating strategic alternatives. So really, these are all things which are based on factors that are within management control and independent of share price. Our phase two model, we haven't applied it yet to in a fund management context. It's still under development and is being back-tested. But we're happy, as I said, with the early results. We feel it can be used as a stock selection tool. And importantly, one that's a stock selection tool that's based entirely on a company's reported financials and current share price. It doesn't rely on any forecast. That was the constraint we imposed on ourselves in doing this modelling. Could you improve on it by putting in your views on a company's forecast earnings or anything else in terms of their financial management? I've got no doubt you could. It's just that wasn't what we set out to do. We were all about doing something that didn't rely on forecasts. So potentially you could combine our work with forecasts to produce something even more powerful.
Thank you. Don, I can see you're itching to ask a question. We do have a few minutes for questions, so please, if you can make your way.
Just a small technical one, probably for Graham. I don't know, that time lag in being able to invest and take advantage of the hopefully outperformance period, you know, seems pretty key. I was wondering how you connect the interquartile graphs, you know, where there's maybe 9% outperformance for the top quartile with the actual observed graphs where there's, you know, a lot lower, and is that partly to do with some of the outperformance being in the period between the end of the reporting, end of the period and when the reports are announced?
That's exactly right. In the quartile charts, so that's including the market reaction to the financials. But when we so we model share price in this modelling stage, we model share price from say June 13 to June 14. But the financials we put in are at June 13, even though that we get them at August. So that modelling will include the market reaction to those financials, and that's why you're seeing such great differentiation. But when we come to seeing whether there's anything more than just that reaction, then we have got to only model from post those financials. So the market's already reacted initially, or you know, to that extent.
I mean, have you thought about, you know, using just the post, you know, the practical period as your explanatory variable rather than the entire period?
No, but certainly it's something to consider.
Well, the back testing showed that period still outperformed on the basis of how the model was currently constructed.
Up until GFC.
Post-GFC, it's fallen away a bit, but it still has a differentiation between first and bottom quartile, so it's still okay. But the reason we haven't run with it exactly yet is because, yeah, we're in a run with it. We want to make sure that it's all working so that you can put your hand on your heart and say everything's okay, whereas, yeah, we have had a bit of a fall away in performance in that post-GFC period. But like I say, there's still a differentiation between the first and the fourth quartile, so it's still saying there's something there, and it's still positive.
And as I said, the filtering that we've done just recently on prior price changes, so that's before June 2013 in that example, seems to improve the performance quite dramatically.
Because, I mean, you know, if you have yield as a factor, there's two, yield can go up for two reasons. Prices come down, or especially because we're looking at trailing yield, prices come down, so the yield's gone up, or the dividend's gone up. One of those is a positive scenario, one of those is a negative scenario. So when you start to build in the price momentum factors in behind there, you start to get even better differentiation.
Any other questions or comments? You have a little bit of time.
I just want to, if I could just pick up, because it's a very good question, Don, and an important one, and I just wanted to just briefly revisit one thing. And for those of you that didn't follow it, I think what you're referring to, Don, is the disparity between what we're seeing really here, where you'd say that top quartile companies are outperforming 11% on average. Why didn't that translate to, if you invested in top quartile, you were getting beating the market by 11%? And as Graham indicated, the reason is because when a company releases its results, it's typically sometime after the balance date, and the share price will respond to that result. In a fund management model, we can't claim credit for that immediate reaction. But what I wanted to highlight is that we've actually been very conservative in our approach to dealing with this issue, because really, we
only started measuring, for our back testing purposes, we only started measuring the performance post the release of results at a point in time when we were sure every company had released its results. In reality, some companies will tend to release it during the month of August, but we said, look, we can't be sure. We didn't know exactly when every company reported their results, so we said we're going to start measuring it as when we're sure everyone has released their results, so we absolutely are being squeaky clean in terms of measuring, getting credit for any share price reaction to the release of those results. So we're putting ourselves in the shoot, in a position, you know, of a share market investor. But the truth is, I mean, for a company that has released its results, say, in August, yes, there could be an immediate share market price reaction to that, but then there could be, after that, further reactions. But if you're an investor, you were in a position to take credit for that share price, that the following share price revisions, but we're not claiming any credit for it here.
In other words, you could have a live ladder of the top quartile as a company result comes out. You could slot it in and then say, OK, has that moved up or down the rankings and make the adjustments throughout that whole period, whereas we're waiting until, if you like, the database is fully populated and then doing the analysis again.
No one's been inspired by that. Well, if you can join me in thanking Kevin, Carrie and Graham for their presentation.